What's a rip?
A rip, commission. That's why we work here.
They make huge rips.
No, I don't. I still don't know how it works.
But you and me, the brokers, right, we're taking home cold hard cash via commission.
Right.
No matter whether our clients make money or lose money, the Duke and Duke get the commissions.
The only thing we don't know is your fee.
My fee
is the free market. And you're part of it. Yeah.
Thank you for joining us. You are listening to Fees Always Win Investment Club podcast, hosted by Chris and Ello, two investors without a strong background in the art of investing, but are learning more every day and taking you along the journey with us. This week, we discuss what is an IPO. And you could find us on Facebook starting last week, iTunes, and probably every other place where you get your podcasts. We appreciate you for liking the page and following us on Facebook. Please leave a comment. Post articles if there's something that comes up that you think will be helpful to others. Call and leave a message on our voicemail line, 281-645-9205. Please leave a rating in on our iTunes page, and if it's 5-star, we'll read it on air.
Right, we're getting our Hollywood movie action on. You know how they film out of place and bring it together. That's what we're doing. But either way, both come out pretty dope. So I hope you all enjoy it.
Well, this week we discuss IPOs, initial public offerings. After we establish stock exchanges, histories, rank, volume, and other topics surrounding it. Every week, I think I know the direction that the show's going. I start doing more research about it and find out more. And the show almost takes its own direction as the research leads where our conversations go about this. And I think the best way we have to start is an extension of our episode 2 weeks ago when we discussed different stocks, where different stocks were listed, but we really didn't go into detail about the exchanges, and that's where we're starting today.
Yeah, basically we're going through the history of stock markets. We're going to break down each stock market, and we're just going to go more in depth into the conversation that we had 2 weeks ago, just better explaining things that maybe people who were listening before were wondering. We can go more in depth on it now.
The definition of a stock exchange is an entity that provides trading facilities for stockbrokers, traders, and to trade stocks, bonds, and other securities that we discussed last week, even those money market securities. There's currently 16 stock exchanges in the world with listed shares that value totaling $1 trillion. The stock market that has the highest amount of shares value listed at $21 trillion is the New York Stock Exchange, and they have the largest by a whole $12 trillion, a distinction earned by NASDAQ that follows second, which lists more than $9 trillion of tradable shares. The top five exchanges in the world, including the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ, are followed by the Japan Exchange Group, the Shanghai Stock Exchange, Euronext, which is the EU-hosted exchange, and while hosting shares valued at $4.3 trillion, the London Stock Exchange misses the top five by $1 trillion and is less than 20% of the New York Stock Exchange valuation. But other major exchanges that you're probably familiar with or have heard before include the Hong Kong, the Shenzhen Stock Exchange, a third Chinese one, and the Canadian TMX.
So looking into stock markets, it's interesting seeing the history of stock markets because what we know as a stock market today, that's more of a newer phenomenon, but it can trace back to the 1100s in France. In France, they had a system where courtiers detained, managed agricultural debts throughout the country on behalf of banks. So that was the first major example of stock exchanges because the men effectively traded debts. So as you go through the history of the stock market, you see it progress into what we know today. Back then, it may have been based on what was going on in the government or individual debts, but the actual stock exchange itself was basically created as a term of covering yourself regarding liability. Because back in the, I want to say it was the 1700s, you had a situation where the East India Group was formed. What happened there was it was all about risk. Basically, people were going toward all over the world selling to the East Indies because they basically had a wealth of goods and trades. So the problem is you can get there, but more times than not, a lot of ships never returned. So in order to cover themselves, what investors did was they invested in shares. So that way, if one ship was lost out of three or four, the investment companies or investors could still make a profit off of it. Basically, the stock exchange that we know today was created out of a limited liability formula. So what was once a situation where people would invest money in shares based on goods that they felt they could get money off of but never really saw returns because a lot of ships never made it back, all of a sudden you put a portion here and a portion there, you get to see your returns. But interestingly enough, the early stocks, they weren't traded in what we know of as the Wall Street of today. They actually were traded out of coffee houses. They were handwritten between people. And then it progressed into what you see today. So eventually, like you said before, the NASDAQ became a competitor for the New York Stock Exchange. And basically, the main two are the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ. But in 2007, the New York Stock Exchange merged with Euronext, becoming the first transatlantic stock exchange. So what you're seeing is a progression regarding the stocks as far as wanting to top each other and continue to be innovative and creating new money. Because with NASDAQ, it was basically creating an electronic, everything was electronically made versus being on the floor, having to have things written out or screaming out for stocks to be traded. So it's just a transition of where it started as early as the 1800s with companies having an idea for what they want to be as far as the stock exchange. Back then, it was a different process. It's just the stocks, you didn't actually have actual stocks for what we have now, but it's still the same process. Now, regarding the stock exchanges, we covered a few previously in our prior episodes regarding NASDAQ, which was founded by security dealers to handle transactions electronically, like I said before. The result of more technology and the limit the auction style exchanges, which was necessary to trade holdings as live tracking, was difficult. A reason why the U.S., for example, had exchanges throughout the U.S., the New York Stock Exchange, Chicago, Miami, Cincinnati, Kansas, and Philadelphia being the oldest. Chris, you were saying something about the Shenzhen Stock Exchange?
Yeah, and so as it grew out of those, a lot of the ones in the U.S., like the New York Stock Exchange just purchased the Chicago Stock Exchange last year, because while they did have the difference between those, the reason why the NASDAQ was found separately is because how transactions are handled. As there was only a certain amount of centralized exchanges of values, that it was done auction style in traditional exchanges up until the NASDAQ really got into the market in the 90s. That if you said, I want to buy GE, I think each share is worth $10, I'm willing to pay that. You have to wait for somebody else to say, yeah, I'll take that, but somebody could outbid you for that share. The New York Stock Exchange listed it live as what the market was doing, so you're able to get a much more accurate assessment. These houses and the NASDAQ transact some of these shares, so that's why they have a bid sell rate, that if the stock is worth $10, they buy everything in between 10 and 11. That way, if they have a bunch of bids come in, they could fulfill them, and it all balances out their transaction list. And hopefully some of the bids they were able to sell, they bought at much less at a much less price. The Shenzhen, I did have it on the notes, are particularly because when combined, just to show kind of the prominence or growth of the Chinese market outside of China, is They have the Shenzhen, the Shanghai stock market, and they have another one. But all these put together are make it the third – are really the country with the second most shares going through it. That you have Hong Kong, you have Shenzhen, you have Shanghai, then you have New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ. Those are your two big groups, and then everything else is really dependent on the rest. So you're seeing a lot of fluctuation as it relates to that. But on the Shenzhen, one of the requirements that you're going to see in a lot of these is NASDAQ and New York Stock Exchange have requirements to list your stock. NASDAQ's requirements are a minimum of 1,250,000 of publicly traded shares. That's not including the executives or the CEO, so you're not counting what Mark Zuckerberg's value is. This is shares that have to be available for public purchase. Companies must also have at least 450 people that own at least 100 share bundles, and that's called a round lot. And or 550 total shareholders that controlled the 1.1 million average trading volume over the last 12 months. And another aspect of getting listed on NASDAQ is they must qualify for one of four annual monetary requirements to indicate a positive cash flow. But to maintain a listing on all of these, your stock, with very few exceptions, has to be valued above $4. When referencing my investments or the stock companies that I'm looking at, that's a concern because the fluctuation of Sprint's always right there between $4 and $6. As they get below that $4 valuation, the company gets delisted, which means there'll be less investment and income coming in.
Right. I think it's interesting with the stock exchanges as far as the overall money that's generated. Like, we're talking trillions of dollars, not billions, but trillions of dollars that's being generated. Now, regarding company valuations, we were talking about that before. You were talking about basically what something's worth, and that's basically how you go over a company valuations and how they're determined. I wanted to kind of go over that a little bit to better explain what that is and how that works, because basically it's setting a value of what it is based on what someone's willing to pay for it. But it's also trying to determine how you calculate the market value, but you also want to utilize market capitalization. You want to decide if the market capitalization is the best value option. Sometimes this method works for publicly traded companies where share values can easily be determined. The only thing about that is a disadvantage is that it subjects the company's value to fluctuations of the market. If the stock market declines due to an external factor, the company's market capitalization will fail even if its financial health is not changed. Because it relies on investor confidence, it's potentially volatile and sometimes an unreliable measure of a company's true value. Many factors go into determining the price of a share of a stock, so the company's market capitalization. So it's best to take the figure with a grain of salt because you're basically going off of what someone's saying and it may not actually be the case. Basically, you're worth what you can negotiate in a sense. Any potential buyer for a company might have similar expectations to the market and place similar value on the company's potential earnings. So you're going off with the potential and what you're believing it can be versus what it actually may be. One thing you want to do, you want to determine the company's current share price. So the share price of a company is publicly available on many websites, including Bloomberg, Yahoo Finance, Google Finance, among others. You want to try researching the company's name followed by stock or the stock symbol, if you know it. You want to make sure you go to search engines to find that information. The stock value that you'll want to use for this calculation is the current market value, which is usually displayed on the stock report page on any of the major financial websites. You want to find the number of shares outstanding. You have the figure out. You'll find the figure out on many shares of the company stock. Sometimes they are outstanding. This represents how many shares the company are held by all shareholders, including both insiders like employees and board members, and external investors like banks and individuals. This information can be found either on the same website as the stock price or on the company's balance sheet under capital stock. By law, all publicly held companies' balance sheets are available online for free. A simple search engine search will turn up any public company's balance sheet. So that's something to keep in mind. You want to look into multiply shares outstanding number by the current stock price to determine the market capitalization. This figure represents the total value of all investors' stakes in the company, giving a fairly accurate picture of the company's overall value. So there are a couple of things you want to do in regards to calculating the market value of a company, because we talked about that before. Market value kind of drives the price. The only thing about the market value is sometimes it's based on what a person is willing to pay, more so on potential than what it may actually be worth at the time.
And good examples of this could be referencing back to the dot-com boom, where you saw a lot of companies get a valuation just because they were on the internet and people said they were going to be the biggest thing since sliced bread. An example is pets.com, which at the time when it was released had a $1 billion valuation. But when you looked at the books, you realize it cost them, for everything they sold, they spent about $1.40 for every dollar that they earned. So the more they advertised, they were speeding up the process of losing money. So there was no way their valuation could be accurate when you have that detailed data. So one of the important parts of understanding a valuation of a company and making sure that it's correct is getting understandings of the company's financials, as Ello indicated. You could find those online by searching it. They usually have to file it every quarter, and so it's referenceable, as well as looking up the news articles to get general understanding of it, or conversations with people that are in that industry might be able to give you a little more insight. As another example to understand how company valuations are determined, one current example for the basketball fans would be the Memphis Grizzlies. Currently, their majority shareholder right now, Robert Pera, he bought the team in 2012 with the group of investors. He only owns 25%. He's the majority shareholder. The other group investors, there's two other ones in particular that have a contentious relationship with them. And when they bought it, the estimate of the sale was $350 million. That means his ownership percentage was 87.5 million. Because him and the other owners don't get along, they had a part of their contract in the buy-sell agreement, which means that all parties have 60 to 90 days to engage in good faith negotiations, and neither Kaplan or Strauss, the other investors, has made a bid, but they are officially on the clock to do so. And when they bought the team when Pera bought the team from the previous owner in 2012, he agreed to the arrangement. So, example, Kaplan, the other contentious party in the relationship, could offer to buy the Grizzlies at a sell price of $1 billion. And Pera would either have to sell his 25% share of the team for 25% of that $1 billion, so he'd earn $250,000. Or he'd have to buy out Kaplan's 14% share of the team of that $1 billion, which would qualify for $140 million. To give some insight, the Atlanta Hawks in 2015 sold for $730 million. That was the year after the Clippers sold for $2 billion. The Rockets just sold for $2.2 billion in 2017. And they estimate that the Grizzlies are worth at least $1 billion, meaning if the owners elect to buy it, Robert Pera will profit $162 million, a 287% gain of his original investment that was less than 10 years ago. And the equivalent for an everyday investor, if you invested $10,000 into something that increased 287% within that time frame, you would have $287,000. Companies that have increased by this percentage in 2016 would include United States Steel, which increased 332%, AK Steel Holdings, which increased 359%. And so those are just some examples, and some companies with large IPOs growth over the same time of more than 200% would be Apsys Bio, stock symbol ANAB, Roku, stock symbol ROKU, and Smart Global Holdings, stock symbol SGHO, all grew 200% over the last 2 years.
200%. Wow.
So, and I think that goes to say, even if you don't get the original investment, there's still an opportunity to make money in these IPOs if you believe in it and you know that it's structured well.
One thing to consider, if you're considering investing in a company, your primary concern should be calculating the company's CAGR. CAGR is the compounded annual growth rate, not its total value or size, because the compounded annual growth rate is how you kind of determine what returns are going to happen and what future profits may be possible. A company's market value can be significantly different than other measures of a company's worth, like book value, net asset value, or physical assets minus liabilities, and enterprise value, another measure that takes debt into account, due to variations in debt obligations and other factors. So these are things you want to think about and look into as well.
Next into the tank is a solution for messy little eaters.
And today I am seeking $1 million for a 5% stake in my company.
I'm seeking $120,000 for 20% equity stake in my company.
$300,000.
$200,000.
We are seeking $40,000 in exchange for a 33% stake of our company.
And as we both mentioned IPOs, there's other ways of valuations. If you're a fan of that show Shark Tank, that's probably the clearest example of all valuation, as the segment you just heard shows. Somebody walks in, they have their company, they say, I think it's worth $27 million, so I'm willing to give a 10% share to one of the sharks for $2.7 million so I can increase production. And they negotiate on that for the entire episode.
Right. And one thing about Shark Tank is not only do you see the process of negotiating or the process of potentially buying or selling, you also see how a company can basically be divided up or changed altogether. You can go in owning 100% of the company and you leave out on 10% of the company, all depending on what you agree upon at the time. So it really gives you an idea of business and how you need to have a sound strategy, and you really need to have an idea of the value you're wanting to ask for your company. Because at the end of the day, when you're negotiating, you're obviously not necessarily going to get everything you want, but you need to have an idea of what you're flexible for, what you're willing to take, and what you're willing to give up on. Because since we're representing Shark Tank, there are several examples of people who may have giving up the company, and it may become a cash cow later, versus other people who are willing to walk away, take their business elsewhere, and become billionaires because of that. So it's all about what you value the company at and what you're willing to put up for it.
And some examples that I saw today were one that walked away was Coffee and Bagels, a dating app, where they offered to buy the entire app for, I think Mark Cuban said $20 million or $15 million, and the lady said no, or the owner said no, and they were right because they've made much more money than that original investment that Mark Cuban was willing to put in. But the same goes for probably some other bad ideas where people decided to hold on to it and walk away, and it might have not been successful, but you have plenty of successful ones that the sharks miss out on. Like, they didn't see the Ring doorbell working or the concept behind it, And if they had just had 10% of the company, they would have gotten part of that $1.1 billion that Amazon just paid for the company.
And that's the thing about it. I'm not going to say it's a crapshoot, but if you really believe in your company, you have to go all in. You can't be in a situation where you see a quick dollar and give up on your idea. I mean, if we go back in history, if you look up the history of Victoria's Secret and what the original owner sold it for versus what it's worth today, he didn't even get a tenth of its actual value. So you really need to have an idea of what you're willing to put up and what you're willing to stand your ground for. Because your idea may be terrible, or it may be a great idea that just needs a couple of tweaks here and there. It can be prosperous for everybody involved. So that's the gamble of it. You have to have some type of idea of what your walking away point, and is it really worth putting up the fight and continuing to go for it, or potentially selling and taking what you can get.
And we've mentioned the words a couple of times now for IPO of what is it and how does it relate to you overall. And an IPO, it's an initial public offering for a company that's already valued and growing. And when you're going public, you're usually trying to get a cash influx so that you could expand whatever your role is, or so original investors could cash out of it. The first modern IPO occurred March 1602 when Dutch East India Company, which Mello earlier referenced, offered shares of the company to the public in order to raise capital. The Dutch East India Company, which was around from 1602 to 1799, peaked at a market cap way, way, way above $1 trillion at $7.9 trillion when adjusted for inflation. To give some equivalence, wow. Dutch East India Company was valued at almost all the companies that are listed on the NASDAQ exchange.
Hold on. Let that breathe for a moment. Let that breathe. All of the companies. That's amazing.
All. And so in the United States, the first IPO public offering was Bank of North America around 1783. So it's not something new, but I know I heard these terms a lot and didn't know what was required for it, for the IPO, and what else you needed to do to grow an organization using an IPO.
Since we're discussing IPOs, I wanted to go over some pros and cons of IPOs, just to give people a better understanding of what they're getting involved in. I want to go over the pros first. Basically, it's a large, diverse group of investors coming together to raise capital. It gives the company a lower cost of capital. It can increase the company's exposure, prestige, public image, which can help the company's sales and profits. Public companies can attract and retain better management and skilled employees through liquid equity participation, ESOPs, but we'll get into that later. It's facilitating acquisitions potentially in return for shares of stock, and it can raise large amount of money for the company compared to other options. Some of the cons that you're looking at with an IPO is that the company becomes required to disclose financial, accounting, tax, and other business information. You can have significant legal, accounting, and marketing costs, which are ongoing. Increased time, effort, and attention required of management for reporting. There's always the risk that required funding would not be raised if the market does not accept the IPO price, sending the stock price lower right after the offering, which is what you don't want. Public dissemination of information, which may be useful to competitors, suppliers, and customers. You have loss of control and stronger agency problems due to new shareholders who obtain voting rights and can effectively control company decisions via the board of directors. There's also the increased risk of legal or regulatory issues such as private security, class action lawsuits, and shareholder actions. So, as Chris said before regarding IPO, it's when the company sells stock to the public. If a firm can convince people to buy stock in the company, it can raise a lot of money. The IPO is seen as an exit strategy for the company's founders and early investors to profit from their early risk-taking in the new venture. Therefore, in the IPO, many of the shares sold to the public were previously owned by those founders and investors. The stock market is referred to as the secondary market, since traders buy and sell stock from other public investors and not from the company itself. Only prior to the IPO does the company issue stock directly to shareholders. This means that when you buy shares of a company, you are not handling your investment money over to the corporation, but instead to whomever sold you their shares. When a company sells shares to the public, the company and its owners still typically retain a significant portion of the total stock. So some early investors and co-founders may still have a great deal of influence on the direction of the company, despite there being a large number of new shareholders. So a lot of information, but just things to take into account when discussing IPOs.
And an extension of what you were referencing in terms of losing control of your organization or having the lack of control, if you issue an IPO, there's normally restrictions on what your initial investors and executive board could do with their shares, where there's normally a lock-in limit time that when it goes public, just because it goes public, you can't sell all of your shares and cash out immediately. There's normally a calendar that identify certain parts where you could sell it off. The difference of that would be our organizations who choose not to do an IPO don't have the same type of restrictions, though they still have to publish their public information and accounting information for the public to understand. One example would be Spotify this week, which was expected to be one of the biggest IPOs of 2018. But because Spotify indicated they don't actually need the cash, they didn't go to banks and set up an IPO. They just wanted to see how the market responded. They didn't list on the NASDAQ. They listed on the New York Stock Exchange, and it went public this previous Tuesday, the week of April 2nd. It became one of the largest tech companies to do so in recent year. The company opened at $165.90 a share, giving it a $29.5 billion valuation based on the 178 million shares that are outstanding available for purchase. It's also noteworthy because the way going public is very unusual. You don't get many that do a direct listing because they want to know that they have the bank's backing. And if it does go down, the bank will hold some of the shares to artificially inflate it. This way, they completely let the public know what it's worth. And so the direct listing, meaning shares will be offered directly to the public investors without any Wall Street banks underwriting it. But what this also does is now other broadcasters, the Pandora, as well as Tidal, the Jay-Z and Kanye one, they could value it against Spotify and say, we have the same type of catalog. We have this amount of members. So based on what our numbers are internally that we don't have to share publicly, we know maybe our company is worth a lot more than a billion. If Spotify's worth 29.5, we're at least worth 15 billion. And that might be a time where you see the lead investors like the Carters sell part of their shares to get back some of that money and actually become the first billionaires of rap after Dr. Dre.
Which is amazing. I mean, think about Spotify. It paid off at the end of the day, but that's a big gamble what they did. But they might be setting a new trend for companies in regards to putting your money up that way and not having to go through a lot of the things that other people would. That's amazing.
Or give away ownership at
the return that they get.
Yeah. And so let's go over some historic offerings. The most valuable offerings that have been for IPOs have been Alibaba Group. You might be familiar with this company as they're the ones that bought Yahoo last year. They debuted at $68, or that $68 a share at $25 billion. And then Visa was the second largest U.S. one before Alibaba, and that was $44 a share at $179 billion. And so the least valuable ones, examples that reflect the market as you were indicating and the risk that you take by going public, you might remember Zynga, which is the company that has all the Facebook games. They were debuted at $10 a share at $7 billion. They were expecting more. Another example would be Vonage. You might have had their phone system at your job. And they're growing concern because the company was valued at $531 million IPO as of May 2006. And it was a disaster. The stock fell 24% in its first 2 days. And problems with the offering led to a class action suit, as all CEOs and public or people involved in the stock have a fiduciary duty to look out to make sure the company makes money. So if they did something and didn't value it correctly or do their due diligence, then shareholders could sue them for not doing their job.
So it's basically, we talk about movies that flop, but, you know, basically you can have IPOs that flop as well, is what you're saying.
Yep. Yep. And to kind of finish off IPOs, in 2017, your other big ones were Roku, Alteryx, Car Gurus, Redfin, Stitch Fit. They all have had returns of more than 50% if you invested in them. So there's still a market and opportunity as these are going public. Expected ones for this year of 2018 is 23andMe, the DNA testing company that's similar to those boxes that they send to your house and they tell you what your ancestry is, as well as right. DocuSign, which almost everybody uses now, and then the Spotify one, which was anticipated to be a big one. But there's also the sports memorabilia dealer, the storefronts that you see in malls, Fanatics, where you could buy jerseys and everything else. They're planning to go public this year. So that one's interesting because as malls are dying, I wonder what the value is, but I'm sure there's more inherent in there that I'm not reading nor understanding because I don't have that experience and that aspect of research.
Right, but that does present an opportunity to read into it moving forward. That is a fair point because malls aren't what they used to be 10, 20 years ago. So that is a fair point.
And when I indicate the valuation of companies, depending that number of what the share price is, how they really value it is how many shares are outstanding as related to the value. So just because Spotify started at the 147 or one, they released it at 100. It went up all the way to 165. It came back down to 147. All right, I'm showing it 147 a share. It's the overall valuation that gives it its value of $29.5 billion based on what they were able to sell out on the market. So right now it's 147. It went up after hours trading 393, but I did want to make that correction. It's now at 147.92. And so I think the last thing we kind of want to cover is crowdfunding. And is crowdfunding a form of IPO or valuation of a product?
That's a good question. I feel like it's more of a valuation. What do you think?
I'm going to say no, only because you don't have any inherent ownership in your participation in crowdfunding. And the example I'm going to use is TLC. When 4 years ago, I'm not even sure if the album was completed, the two remaining, T-Boz and Chili, crowdfunded an album. They're only guaranteed to the people who crowdfunded that if you donated $10, you'll get a CD for free. You just basically paid for the work up front. But they didn't say if you donated the $10, then you'll get a residual if we make more than we think that you might make more off your $10. So I don't think it's actual form of valuation because there's no inherent there's no inherent valuation tool for it, because you're just selling the product ahead of time, maybe taking a loss, but nobody's making a bunch of money from crowdfunding. You're giving away your money for a product.
Right, that you don't necessarily know if there might necessarily be a return for in the first place.
Or if the product ever makes it there.
Right. You're hoping for it, but there's nothing to really support it, no data to show that there will be anything that comes from it. Okay, that's a fair point.
Well, and on the last topic for today, and if anybody has anything to add on that, please let us know. Put it on the Facebook page, or email us at feesalwayswin@gmail.com, or leave a message at 281-645-9205, 281-645-9205. And we'll be happy to discuss it live on the air, or discuss it afterwards on a review show. We won't be live if you call that. But let's talk about our stock updates. I'll start with mine, or I'll just kind of go through them this week. Sprint Corporation down negative 2.83% from when we started this. Parsley Energy's come back down to earth. It's only up 0.55%. Micron Technology is down 11% from when we started this.
Yes, it is.
And General Electric is down 12%. They actually rebounded a little after last week. What are your insights on your stocks this week? And then I'll follow up with mine.
Well, I was reading an article that was talking about potentially selling Micron. This may be a sign to sell. I think, however, it may be, I feel like you... I mean, I kind of want to hold on a little bit further to see the potential of it, because I feel like it can be, actually become a powerhouse moving forward. As far as GE, I think it's interesting. We talked last week about Warren Buffett making his comments, and then you see GE start to make a little bit of a gain. I'm kind of shaky on GE, though, only because for what he said, I would imagine the expectation would have been to see even more growth from that. I don't know if GE can get out of the slump that it's in. So that's my biggest concern. What about you with Parsley? Well, Parsley Energy, there's potential there, but Sprint, I think, was your biggest concern, regarding where it was. How are you feeling?
Well, Parsley Energy is the most shaking one, because there's not as much information out there about it as a big company, because it's really going to go with the market. I thought with the announcements of the restriction of the oil flow, but now China indicates they're going to release more oil than they usually do, and Saudi Arabia supports that, that might make a big difference to it. But Parsley, the earnings release are coming out, I think, next week, so that'll make a big difference for it. It's just, that's a real volatile one. If I was a day trader, I probably could have capitalized off of it, especially if I had enough volume of trading. But at this point, mm-hmm. I kind of got to hold on to it until it bounces up, or I'm just going to lose money on it. Sprint, I don't understand how Sprint stock is valued. That's the lesson I'm getting out of all this. I look for articles for insight. I look for what's determining it from day to day. And it looks like they're really reactive to what else the market is doing. That AT&T made a lot of changes this week. Charter is trying to merge with somebody. You have the discussion of the Time Warner merge with AT&T. But none of this directly affects Sprint, so I'm not sure why there's so much volatility in the stock. It's finally getting closer to the point where we started this, but it's perplexing. What's ironic is I read a lot more about your stocks just to understand, because I knew nothing about Micron, and I see that two things could be affecting them. As they're a chip maker, the decrease in cryptocurrency pricing is decreasing the desire for new people to get into it, so there's less demand for chips, and also that they're an overseas manufacturer. And that is one of the things listed. If it comes in the country, there might be a tariff to go along with it, and that could be a concern all around. So I think there's a couple of parts there with Micron that it might not all be them. It's the market surrounding them that's really helping make that determination. And GE, yeah, I know nothing about GE except they sold their their division a couple years ago, the appliances, they just let somebody use the logo. So quality has gone down, and that's one thing that I keep reading is complaints about their household goods and people losing that respect or value for the products as they don't last in the way that they used to.
Yeah, the biggest thing that's affecting basically everything right now is the potential trade war that may happen. I mean, regarding the text that you sent me regarding the drop in stock, that's the biggest fear all around right now is the potential trade war, and hoping that doesn't destroy everything. So if we can get that squared away, we may start to see changes all around, but that's the biggest fear right now, just hoping that doesn't become something that affects everything we're trying to do.
And it's interesting now that when I read an article, I directly relate it to the market. And you mentioned this yesterday when we weren't talking on air for the show. That's just kind of changed how I look at everything that takes place. If I see it come across Yahoo or Google News, I directly go to the finance page or go to the stock app to see what else is happening and how that reflects. And hopefully that gives me insights into the future on how to play the market.
Right. Also, I mean, this is widely known, so this isn't me taking a political stance, but depending on how our president tweets and what he talks about, that has a big impact on the market as well. So I set alerts on my phone, so when the president starts tweeting, I need to see what's going on, see how the market may sway one way or another.